And what are some of the other factors that need to be in place for somebody to get married other than insurance? Income, okay, if it's a guy, he has to be able to support his wife, okay. What else? Sisters? I think there's four, right?
Whatever. There's two more.
One of them had to do with the necessary knowledge, right? Like you have to know the rules of rights and responsibilities of a spouse according to the Islamic perspective. If you don't know these responsibilities, then you won't be able to perform them. And I think there was a fourth one as well, too. Oh, yes, yes, sometimes it can come wajib as well, too. And that was the fourth point that we made. Yes. Good, thank you, sister. Okay, now, now once somebody is ready, then there's some benefits in marrying when they're ready as opposed to delaying. Right, quickly, what are some of those benefits? For example? You get to enjoy the world more, God gives you more because you marry at a younger age. What else? God wants us to enjoy this world, right? And marriage is one of those ways of enjoying ourselves. I mean, there's a lot of pleasure that somebody can gain both from a worldly perspective and from a spiritual perspective when they get married. And so this is one of the reasons why we want to get married at a younger age. Any other reasons that we talked about? I think about having kids earlier, right? I think that was one of the points as well, too. That's one of the benefits, because having children itself is a great way of building ourselves and of acting upon the request and the recommendation of the Prophet of Islam. And then we talked about some common barriers that prevent people getting married on time. And then we talked about the matchmaking cycle. So somebody who wants to get married, at least this is the cycle that I'm recommending. What's the first step that they would want to do then if they want to get married? They would make the intention to get married, right? Like, it's just like they can treat it like an act of ibadah. In a sense, like, I'm doing this thing to please Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, to get closer to Allah, and step into the whole process with that mindset. It doesn't even have to be at the point where they're necessarily actively looking, because there's some steps that need to take place even before somebody is actually actively looking. Okay, we'll get to that. So other than the intention that we talked about, this two rak'ah prayer that somebody should perform, and tawakkul and tawassul. I wanted to make one addition here to what we talked about. Tawakkul and tawassul, even though you do it at that point, when you're trying to find a spouse, it doesn't just end there. It's going to be something that continues throughout the whole process. From the time that we're coming up with our list of haves and of what want to have and like to have, when we're talking to potential candidates, when we're trying to make the decision, and even beyond that as well too, like tawakkul and tawassul are always there. Whenever we have, like this world is such that we face so many difficulties, so many challenges that are beyond us. The only true way of dealing with them is by having tawakkul and tawassul. And somebody who does that will lead a much more comfortable, much more peaceful life than somebody who doesn't have these tools in their lives. That's why the life of a believer is different than the life of a non-believer. The life of a believer is filled with comfort and ease because they have things like tawakkul and tawassul to rely upon. And briefly, what is tawakkul? Okay, that's trust in Allah. And I think you explained it in a nutshell.
Doing your part,
Doing your part, your duty, and then leaving the rest of it in God's hands. And then tawassul is, of course, seeking the intercession, seeking the help of the Ahlul Bayt as the ones who Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has placed as means of achieving things in this world and in hereafter. Okay, and then we talked about how there's one important point we made, which was that every marriage can be made successful if the two parties are willing to try. And even if marriages that seem to be dismal, seem to be going towards divorce, if the two parties commit themselves towards reorienting themselves according to Islamic ideals, they can, at least the teachers of ethics and spirituality, they say that they can make things work out, and God will help them. And this is the promise of God in the Quran as well too. And then finally we talked about love marriage, and we point out some of the faults of just somebody, two people falling in love and then deciding to get married afterwards. And the love that comes, the true love that comes after somebody does things in a more Islamic way, according to the Islamic guidelines, is something which far outpowers any type of love that somebody might gain just by falling in love with somebody as a result of emotions and passions. Okay, now, we're going to continue today, inshallah, first talking about... Go up a few slides. Please. Up, up, up. Somehow it jumped.
Go backwards?
Yeah. Up, 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 one more. Okay. Talking about ideal traits and traits to inculcate, and then we're going to talk about how somebody actually goes about finding a spouse. I just want to make a correction to something I said last time. And so those of you who hear this, please convey to those who aren't here right now, but who were there at that time. Last week, somebody asked about the nafaqa, the wajib expenditure that the husband has to provide for the wife. And I said last week that, generally speaking, the fuqaha have said that that amount is according to her status, depending on what background she's coming from. If she's coming from like a, you know, a couple of income brackets higher than the husband, then he has to provide for her at her level, unless they come to an agreement and she agrees to like be supported at a lower level, right? Now that's correct. That is the general opinion among the fuqaha. But in particular, when it comes to Ayatul Sistani's ruling, he has another clause there, and it was something I was confused about, but then I got it clarified with one of my teachers, and it seems that this is what Ayatul Sistani is trying to say. He says that yes, it is the case that the wife has to be provided for at her level, the background that she's coming from. But that's still relative to what the husband can provide. Okay, so for example, in a nutshell, let's try to like just boil it down to like, let me just give you an example. Okay. According to the standard opinion, okay, if there's a guy, he's in income bracket three. Okay, and there's a woman, and she's coming in from income bracket one, then he has to provide for her at income bracket one level, right? If there's a woman and she's coming in income bracket five, he has to provide for her at income bracket five. Okay, depending on what the culture determines that somebody at that income bracket should be provided for. Okay, that's the standard opinion. According to Ayatollah Sistani, what it seems like he's saying is that, no, it's a little bit more sophisticated. The person who's coming in at income bracket one, and if the guy's at three, the wife is coming at income bracket level one, he has to provide for her, but relative to him. Meaning that he has to look at his ability and look at where she's coming from and then provide accordingly. So he'll give more than if he had just taken her income bracket into account, not with relation to his income bracket. But the same way when it comes to somebody who's coming at income bracket level five, and he's at income bracket level three, he won't provide for her just looking at the fact that she's coming from income bracket level 5, but he'll take into account that he's in level 3 and then appropriately spend for her. So that means that he doesn't have to spend outside of his, you know, his abilities. Okay, does that make sense? Okay. If there's more questions, we can talk about it later, inshallah. That's just a minor point. At the end of the day, this type of thing has to be discussed and you know, agreed upon before they start living together, that this is the standard of living that the husband is going to be providing for the wife. But also, it should be one of those things that the husband does provide for the wife. Just because in the West, like, you know, it's kind of like, okay, you're on your own, you have your own bank account, you have your own, you know, your own job, and you make your own money, and, you know, we'll split the grocery bill. We shouldn't have that type of attitude. Like, the wife should know that she's being provided for the husband. If she's making other income through whatever means, that's her money, and she doesn't have to spend it on the family. And that will create the type of atmosphere of like of support and dependence on one another and helping each other fulfill each other's responsibilities that is part of an Islamic marriage. Okay, so let's begin with the salawat, please.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad.
Alright, please, the next slide. Alright, traits of an ideal spouse. If we look at the traditions of the Ahlul Bayt, they are telling us to get married, but they don't just leave us with that. They're telling us whom we should look for when we're getting married. And they say, okay, marry your, for example, the moms will talk to the companions, the male companions, and tell them, marry your daughters to this person, don't marry them to that person. And if you look at the traditions, there's a lot of advice. It's one of those areas where, alhamdulillah, they didn't leave us in the dark. Because the Ahlul Bayt, they taught us how to live, and they wanted us to live according to their guidelines. There's a lot of different choices that we could make, a lot of different you know, potential people that people could marry, right? I mean, there's a whole world out there. But they told us how to narrow down and find that right person. You know, when we look at this, we have to treat it seriously. We have to really like say that, okay, if they're saying this, if I'm gonna ignore this advice and instead do things my own way, well then I'm on my own. after, if I'm somebody who is really concerned about this world and hereafter, then I would say that, okay, these are the people who have that vision, who have that knowledge to be able to tell me what's good for me in this world and in hereafter. So that feeling of submission, that feeling of acceptance should be there within us. If not, then we're setting ourselves up for potential failure, if not in this world, then in the hereafter. But when we look at this, since they're emphasizing them so much, it's not just about, oh, what we should be looking at in others. And that's contrary to the spirit of like of self-development and in general of like the way that we should be looking at this world. I remember, I'm just throwing in these anecdotes here just to like, you know, lighten things up, inshallah, give you more perspective than just like, you know, the facts, you know. I remember one time, you know, like this group came to visit Iran, because the Arab group. And one of my teachers was there and he was giving them advice about how to maximize the experience from this visit to Qom, the Haram of al-Bayt in Islam. And he told me something interesting. He said that, okay, you're here right now. If you want to, you can find a lot of faults in the people around you and in this city, right? Whether it comes to the taxi driver, the store owners, you know, you can pick on many, many things. Because you're expecting that this would be Shia, Muslims, Islamic revolution, everything's going to be, you know, 100% fine and dandy. But when you look at the reality, there's room for improvement. And you could, if you want, pick on everything. And people have been, people have gone for ziyarat, and the whole time they just criticize this, the traffic, the people, the, you know, whatever, the ta'aruf, and the other things, right? Those of you who don't know what that is, we can talk about later. So. But he said that that's not the right way of doing it. The right way of doing it is to say that, okay, I'm here to not look at other people's faults, but to look at my own and to figure out how I'm gonna find the solution to solving my problems. Right? I actually need to focus on my own faults. Right? But not be distracted by the shaitan where he lets me become busy thinking on other people's faults rather than looking at my own. If we apply that to what we're discussing here, when we're talking about these traits we want to look at other people, first we have to say, wait a minute, do I have them in myself? Right? I mean, that's the first step. And as somebody who is, inshallah, who has that desire to get married as soon as those conditions are met, then from now, I need to be starting and looking to see how I can inculcate these traits within me. Right? This is important. I remember when I was looking to get married back in the days, probably the previous century too, I don't know. Maybe, yeah, it was actually previous, okay. So that's how old I am.
Right off, man.
So I remember I went to somebody to seek advice, so I said, okay, can you please, somebody I respected, right? I said, please give me an advice, how am I going to, what should I be looking for in this person I'm going to meet? So he said, okay, look for taqwa. I said, taqwa, right? So I said, how do you find out what taqwa is, right? So he said, that, okay, the way you find out is ask her, do you recite namaz al-shab? Do you recite salat al-layl? I was like, oh, okay. No, that just got me thinking because okay, I'm asking that person, that, you know, this lady, if she's doing namaz al-shab, what about myself? You know, that's like being holier than thou. So that it kind of jolted me into thinking that, wait a minute here, you know, like just the same way that we're looking for these traits in other people, we need to be looking at them in ourselves as well too. And then because the Ahlul Bayt, thank you. Because the Ahlul Bayt emphasizes so much, it's not just about having these things at the start, but it's about carrying them throughout. Like, I remember, like, this is something that you've definitely seen before. Alright, a guy gets engaged, you know, in an Islamically halal way. Alright? Maybe it happens with sisters as well too, but I've seen it in guys. Guy gets engaged, alright, marriage is in 9 months. He hits the gym. You know, he gets the membership at the gym and then, you know, he's there. Like, he's working out, he's exercising, right? And in 9 months, the guy goes from being, you know, like having a pot belly and like, you know, I don't know, looking just like, you know, unkempt, and to being like, you know, really cut, right? And then you see him 9 months after the wedding and he's back to the way he was before. You know? Have we seen this? Yes? Okay, we've seen this. Right? You know, what's going to happen 9 years later then, you know? Like, I don't know. But
what if you're all bone?
So, but this thing happens, right? And it's a wrong attitude to have. If they're emphasizing these things, these are characteristics and traits that we need to be aiming to obtain early on in our lives, and then keeping up and only growing and increasing in them. That's what marriage is about. That's what's going to help our marriages be successful. Now, so somebody who is here, whether you're married or not married, this applies to you. Therefore, somebody who is wants to get married, what they're going to do is they're going to use these characteristics to compile a list of must-have and nice-to-have characteristics. We're going to talk about that, inshallah. But these things that the Ahlul Bayt mentioned, because they're mentioning it, they have to be falling in the must-have. If they said it's must-have, then it should be must-have for us as well too. Okay, so we've gone to this point in the recommended matchmaking cycle where we talked about intention. Oops, sorry. Intention, talk about this. Okay, I've added one here too, which is self-building. And that comes on the basis of what I just discussed right now, that from the time that somebody has this intention to get married, they should be involved in self-building and trying to inculcate those characteristics into their self, into their soul. And then we're about compiling a list of must-have and nice-to-have traits. Alright. Now, when we're compiling the list, what we need to do is we need to sit down and actually compile a list. Take that time out of our day. And it's going to be something that will be a gradual process where we'll think about it, we'll come up with some things, and then we'll go and consult with other people, we'll come up with some other ideas, or just, you know, through inspiration, we'll get some other ideas, then we'll come back and improve and revise. It will be a gradual process that takes some time, but we have to actually make this list. This involves understanding what kind of personality we are, our strengths, our weaknesses, and then the future needs we have from our spouse. This goes beyond just these traits that we're discussing of taqwa and other things. There are people who have different needs. For example, there's some people who have a dire need to, I don't know, to like have people, you know, appreciate their jokes. Okay, they're jokers, they need people to appreciate them. There's other people who, for example, need somebody to look up to them and to respect them, to show them respect, otherwise they feel dejected, etc. We need to identify what kind of personality type we are. And doing this process itself is very rewarding. I just want to share a couple of traditions. It's reported that Imam al-Islam said that the ignorance of a man or a woman with respect to his faults is among the biggest of sins. For somebody to be in a state thinking that, you know what, they're okay, they don't have any faults, you know, there's no room for improvement, that itself is a big mistake. Everyone has room for improvement. Everyone has certain types of faults that they have in their character or in their action or in their ideology. So identifying these is actually a great blessing, and it can help us a great deal, because then it shows us how we can target ourselves as we're trying to aim at building ourselves. And then on the other hand, in a positive note, Imam Sadiq al-Islam says that if Allah wants good for a servant, He gives him three things. He gives him zuhd, He disattaches him from the world. Second, He gives him knowledge. He gives him deep insight. Fit faqahahu fi din. He gives him deep insight, or faqahahu. He gives him deep insight into the religion. And thirdly, is that He teaches him and shows him his faults. And that's something which is a great blessing of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, for somebody to be able to identify their faults. So what we're trying to do now is we're going to look at the advice from the Ahlul Bayt when we're coming up with our list, because that's going to help kind of, you know, categorize it and come up with those big ones that we're looking for. I just want to remind us all that we're not going to find somebody who matches in every category at 100%. We need to keep our expectations reasonable. But there's some things that we're not going to be able to compromise on. So trait number one, what we see mentioned again and again in the advice of the Ahlul Bayt is to look for somebody who has taqwa. Right, now we're going to be a little bit more specific about that. Taqwa means protection. And one way of looking at it perhaps is to say that it means acting in a way that one is protecting himself from turning away from God and receiving His punishment. Like taqwa comes from the word waqaya. The root word is waqaya in Arabic, and it means like guarding oneself. Okay, so what are we guarding ourselves against? Is punishment of God that we would receive by acting in a certain way, and it's a state that somebody has about them. It's something that somebody can acquire by practicing it again and again and again. By obeying God and staying away from disobedience, then they acquire this state about them that when they go through their daily lives, they are protected from and immune from disobeying God. Now this has varying degrees. It's not just at one level. It's something that if we, like when we talk about taqwa, when people define it as being observing the wajibat, staying away from that which is haram, that's the first level of it. It's a very serious level. It's a very difficult level for somebody to attain in its full sense. Because a lot of people don't even know what wajibat and haram, what those things are haram that they have to stay away from. You know, I mean, you ask somebody these days about, like, you know, about khums, somebody deals with khums, or about ghiba, or some of these other things. You know, sometimes people aren't aware of these things, right? They're not aware of their duties. So it's not an easy thing to attain, but it is step one. And above and beyond that, there's many degrees of taqwa that people attain. But at least at the first level, right, of that somebody, if there's somebody who's committing themselves to being a slave of God, they're acting on what they know, they're staying away from what's haram and doing what's wajib on them. And there's a lot of traditions about this. I just want to share one as an example. One who marries his noble daughter to a sinner, somebody who doesn't have taqwa, receives 1,000 curses on a daily basis. A curse means that he is being cast away from the mercy of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. This is showing us that it's something which is extremely important when finding a spouse. People who say that taqwa comes at second or third or fourth priority, who say that, no, I'm actually, like a guy who says, I'm actually looking for a sister who doesn't observe hijab, then they are exactly going contrary to these teachings of the Ahlul Bayt. It's so saddening. It saddens me when I hear these type of things coming from men, okay, or vice versa. So why is it important? Just some examples, okay. When the man and woman are home alone, right? If they do not see God in the picture, and it's just the two of them, then after that honeymoon period wears out, and they start to face difficulties. Remember, we talked about this, that marriages do have difficulties, that's okay. Then, if they don't have taqwa in the picture, then there's no holds barred. It'll just be like two people, and it's just me, and it's you, and you know, you have no right to do this, and you know, I've done so much for you, and you know, what on earth was my dad thinking when he, you know, like when he found you, and whatever, all these things, you know, it's just, everything goes out the door, all type of civility, all type of like respect, all type of God, anything about God. On the other hand, somebody who has God in the picture, at all times, they're able to see themselves not as being, you know, like an antagonist, you know, but rather they're seeing themselves as doing their best to see what they can do to help this person achieve perfection. And it changes completely the way marriages will work. Imam Hassan al-Islam says, marry your daughters to a man who has taqwa. For if he loves her, he will honor her. And if he dislikes her, he will not be unjust to her. Okay? I mean, he will honor her. If he dislikes her, then he's not going to be unjust to her. No, he'll still be fair to her. And he'll do those things necessary in order to try to help her improve so that that love does come in. Because that love will come. God promises that love between the two hearts. There's other traditions as well which are even more severe than this. Like there's one tradition where one of the Ahlul Bayt recommends this. He says that marriage is slavery. Okay? And so be careful as to whom you enslave your daughter to. Alright, now, this tradition, let's not get it interpreted in the wrong way. Okay? Marriage is not, and if you're watching this on the internet, don't just like clip out this one part here and then say, oh, this is what, you know, students from home are saying. No, marriage is not slavery, okay? But in order to convey the gravity of the situation, you're basically handing over this woman into, you know, a man's hands. And when they're alone, if the man wants to do things like abuse her, you know, disrespect her, because he tends to be more, have the physical power, right, he can do that. And there's no one else in the picture. So I'm saying be very careful about whom you're handing your daughter to, right? Because if he wants, he can treat her like a slave driver. Not that that's, he's condoning that, but he's just saying about the severity of how you have to make this, make the right decision. Okay, also, you know, looking at things, you know, there's a lot of benefits for having taqwa, but even if, you know, when things go sour, if the person doesn't have taqwa, then, you know, it turns into court cases, it turns into alimony, it turns into, you know, paying for two homes and what do they call that, restraining orders, and, you know, you've seen this, the whole thing, you know, and then basically all type of Islamic teaching with regards to what happens when they divorce and who takes custody of the kids and all that, they just, you know, shove out the door and then they can take advantage as much as possible of the laws. They even accuse the husband sometimes. I'm not saying that all the cases it's not that they're wrong, but sometimes it's not fair. I mean, they're accusing the husband unjustly of doing these things, etc. And the same applies to the other side as well too. Yes, there's a question?
Or can we ask questions now?
Yeah, please. Yeah, I would like to have interaction to a moderate extent.
That word of enslavement, what is that word in Arabic, and does it mean exactly that, or does it mean something else?
Yeah, it means exactly that. It's like, I believe it's like, it's from Rifqa or Raqq or something, which means that, you know, slavery is, that particular hadith, like, it refers to slavery. I think we might have another presentation a little bit later, just like. Okay, now, this presentation isn't just talking about, you know, what we should be looking for, but also about how we can inculcate these traits within ourselves. How we can even, you know, those of us who have children or inshallah are going to have children, how we can try to encourage them to also build these traits as well too. So I've tried to include a practical bent to this so that inshallah all of us can benefit. How to improve one's taqwa? So first of all, the first thing is to improve our creed. We need to understand at a level of certainty why we believe what we believe. Okay, and this is something that everyone can look at. If they have any doubts about the religion, about the existence of God, starting from there, all the way to, like, you know, religious pluralism, to like evolution, to the justice of God, to the Day of Judgment, to hell and heaven, whatever it may be. These needs to be ironed out. We have a tradition which shows the importance of having solid and sound creed when it comes to marriage. The Imam Ali Islam says, "Do not marry your daughter to one who has doubts and who doesn't have. He's not certain about things, right?" Because if you do so, the wife is going to adopt the etiquette of her husband, and he will impose his faith on her. Alright, now this is something that you can just look at the people that you know. How many times is it that the, percentage-wise, how many times is it that the husband takes on the religiosity of the wife, versus the wife taking on the religiosity of the husband? Most of the time, I think you'll agree with me, is most of the time the wife takes on what the husband practices. Alright? There are some cases where it's backwards, but those are, I think, more the exception rather than the norm. That's step one. Step two is learning about our practical responsibilities and acting upon them. We've talked about that both today and also in the previous nights, so I won't elaborate on that. Yes?
You know, this case, actually, like, I heard this speech from Iran, this honor, he was saying that actually, it's more happening from the wife's side. He was saying a good wife takes a bad husband to heaven, and a bad wife takes a good husband to hellfire because of you know, what they require of him, or, you know, these worldly desires of what they need to have, and they make the husband go out of his way to be able to provide those things for them. Especially in my country where, you know, unfortunately, women's voice is louder than the men's.
Yeah, this is talking about creed, in
particular. There's no...
Okay, yeah, but aqeedah, like the belief system that somebody has, in particular. Like what type of
doesn't
belief
does it affect that though?
I think what you're talking
you mean
about.
Religiosity? Oh my God.
What you're talking about is his practice.
I apologize, yeah. I apologize. I was thinking about totally letting go of the religion and going the wrong path.
Right. Okay. Another thing is that teachers recommend is to have a small regular program of mustahaba on a daily basis. We should be engaging in that. And that is something that will help us perform the wajibat and staying away from that which is haram. I think we talked about this as well too, but this should consist of muraqabah, muhasabah, we'll get to that a little bit later, of like doing Qur'an, dhikr of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, du'as, spending some time, you know, after prayer on the prayer mat, not just getting up right away, praying on time, and giving charity on a daily basis, and etc. Okay, this is something which is very important. And then finally, receiving spiritual admonishment on at least once a week, meaning that once a week you're hearing words from a source which is hitting your heart and waking you up and taking you away from the ghafla and that heedlessness which settles in if we don't hear this type of spiritual admonishment. We can go around reading about things, learning about things, you know, doing our worship, but if we don't hear encouragement, you know, in the form of like spiritually, you know, uplifting advice and admonishment and warnings, then we'll find ourselves slowly, our charge will drain away. I don't know if I shared this with you, but brothers have reported that like in Qum, those who attend these types of classes, they tend to take place in the evenings rather than in the mornings when you have more academic type of classes. Brothers have reported consistently that when they come out of these type of sessions, if that person who's giving them is a qualified teacher from the Ahlul Bayt and Islam, who's teaching only the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, not putting his own stuff in there, they find themselves recharged, like very strong. And this stays with them, you know, for a day, 2 days, 3 days, 4 days, you know, and then until the next week comes along. Alright. Some other pieces of advice is participating in congregational activities. This is very important. People who are loners, first of all, the shaitan comes after, you know, the lone sheep in the flock, right? And the people who are loners who stay away from the community, stay away from the congregation, will be more likely prey of the shaitan. But also, if we're participating in congregation, then what we're doing is we're telling the world, we're telling ourselves, and we're telling the world that, you know what, I am, this is how I am, this is who I am, this is what I do. You know, like, this is the type of person that I pray, I talk well, I have good etiquette, you know, I have good friends. I'm telling people who I am. And even though I'm not doing it for that purpose, when it comes time for me to find somebody who's a good spouse, this will make a lot of difference. Because then it'll be like, yeah, that brother, everyone in the community knows him, and everyone is willing to attest to his, you know, piety, his taqwa. Same thing with the sisters. And so participating, it can really help us as well too. And I mean, in the sense of like trying to spread the message of Islam, trying to learn together, trying to bond together, trying to have friends among in the community, trying to socialize among the people who can help us get to God. These type of things are extremely important in helping to maintain our taqwa, especially in this environment. If we're people who say that, okay, no, you know what, I'm going to have taqwa, but I'm going to do it on my own. I'm going to have my own set of friends who aren't part of the community. I'm not going to be involved myself in congregational activities. I think it's going to be very difficult for us to actually be able to hold on to the taqwa. Keeping good company is very important as well too. It's useful, of course, when it comes to our preserving our own spiritual states. And even when it comes to marriage, Imam Ali Islam says that if someone's level of practice isn't clear to you, if you want to know what kind of person somebody is and you can't tell, you didn't know them, then look at what kind of friends they have. If they have a high level of religiosity, then it's a good chance that so does he. And another hadith tells us that the human being takes on the religion of his friends. And as you know, you've seen this yourselves. You know, like the more time you spend with people, who, like if you ever, I don't know, here's another example other than the driving example that I used in that one night. That if you ever have you ever watched a horror movie, right? Yeah. Okay, so when you get up from the horror movie, right? For some time, whenever anything like moves in the dark or like, you know, you're a little bit startled, right? Like how many of you ever like kept the nightlight on? You know, in particular, I mean, after you watch the horror movie, just because. Okay, thank you for being honest about it. Why is that, right? Just watching that horror movie is enough for us to like. It changes in that way, right? Temporarily. So it's the same thing. We're hanging around people who aren't good company without even trying. That thing will affect us. And I see this happening. I see this happening when I see people and you know the type of company that they keep, how they change from year to year. It's something which is very apparent. Also, there's a set of issues relating to chastity and modesty that's going to come up, inshallah, later. Any questions or comments?
Yeah, especially when you mentioned the horror movies.
Yeah.
The fact that it's violating the soul of a believer.
Polluting, yeah.
Like, for example, like especially like those, there's certain movies that make, you know, that shows like, you know, like torture of human beings.
Yeah.
Which is, and it's not like the funny stuff anymore. it's really like, I felt my, you know, and people make fun of you, and there's some other ones that say, oh, he's scared. They know it's not being scared, it's that you don't want to violate your, yeah. Right? Isn't that true?
It's interesting, you know, there's a side point here. You know, what's interesting is, you know, there's some professions which are considered makruh from the Islamic perspective. Makruh mean in and of themselves. If there's a need and nobody else is doing them, then it becomes wajib on people to do it. One of these professions is being a butcher. Another one is like selling kafan. Right? And the reason is because of the effect that it has on the soul. Right? When you see this type of gore and blood every day, then you become kind of desensitized. Right?
Okay. Except unless you're a halal butcher.
If you're not a halal butcher, then it's not even like falling into the category of hunger, right? Well, I'm not saying it's not, but I'm just saying that, you know, we're talking in the context of like halal, right?
That's true.
Okay. I didn't mean that. Sorry, I didn't mean that to target that anyone in particular.
I did both of them.
I'm sorry.
Very massive.
I honestly didn't have that in mind when I said that.
Can you please remind the audience not to do the same?
It's not sin. It's not sin.
Pretty close to sin.
No, it's not. No, I'm not. No, I have. There's butchers, and you know, we respect. I mean, may God bless the butchers. Right? They do a lot for us.
You
know, I love my butchers.
You would always laugh, Rocky.
I'm just thinking.
Who? He's gonna cut it himself? With this game,
I'm just making an observation. Nothing against the butchers. May God bless them.
With
more complete right? What's awesome is if you have a butcher who's blessed by God, right? Then it's like he was able to overcome.
And there's a lot like that. I know.
Yeah. So, okay, humble. Okay, let's move on. Right? Any description? Okay. Second trait is good akhlaq. What is akhlaq? Akhlaq. What we mean by that is. One of the scholars puts it this way. I thought it was a beautiful definition. He says that, okay, if you have knowledge about something, okay, and then you act upon that knowledge, the resulting effect of that light which is created in your soul, that is akhlaq. Right? Somebody who learns something, and then they don't act upon it, right? Well, that's just knowledge, right? It's not going to help them. Somebody who acts and doesn't have knowledge, well, there's going to be blundering and making mistakes, right? It's like those people who don't say salam on Day of Ashura or something like that. Okay. It's like, you know, why aren't you saying salam? You know, like, because of lack of knowledge, they think that, you know, okay, this is something that we can't say salam when somebody says salam. Salam, answering salam is a wajib, right? Or so many other things when people do the wrong thing because they don't have the knowledge. So what I'm saying is that somebody who acts without knowledge, then that doesn't help either. Somebody who knows something and then acts upon it, that's when you see the results. And the result is that their inside becomes light, and that inner light reflects in outer characteristics. Okay, the type of akhlaq we're talking about is the Islamic version of it. There's a whole other type of akhlaq that other people talk about, which is non-Islamic, which is something else, right? Where it's about being, you know, just having a smile on your face and, you know, just kind of like, I don't know, you know, joking around a lot and like being pleasant. That's all good, right? That's all part of being an Islamically good akhlaq type of person. But what we're talking about is that which stems from within and then reflects itself on the outside. And it stems from having knowledge of what we do and then acting upon it. For example, right, because this is an important point, I just want to I'm spending a little more time. Somebody understands that this universe is in the possession of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. He owns everything. Alright. Now, they see that one of their classmates is really getting advanced when it comes to this world. Okay, they're getting their medical school. They're about to graduate. There's a big salary, whatever. I'm not picking on anybody. I don't know if anybody here is a medical school. I'm just giving an example. They have a nice car. They have a nice home. Whatever. Everything's setting up for them, and they're just stuck in something, you know, not as good. So they look at that and they feel that this feeling in them that okay, why is that person, you know, getting this? Why am I not getting this? And they start to get a little bit jealous about it. Right? Somebody who sees the world in the hands of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, and he's being the one who disposes out of his own will, that person will be like, okay, you know, that person doesn't own that thing that he has. Allah has just given it to him temporarily at his disposal. And everything I have, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala knows about that, and he gives me whatever I need. He takes care of me. He's my God, he's my Lord, he's all merciful. And there's no reason for him to hold back unless it's in my own best interest. So that person is going to have a calm personality as a result. The other person, they might act calm, but inside of them, they're stressed out. Okay, and then they'll show that stress. They want to release that stress by doing crazy things, right? That's why they'll go up on Friday nights and go to the pub and, you know, get drunk or something, right? The Muslim, no. The Muslim is somebody who is calm, and then they're really calm, right? And then that shows in all in their actions and their behavior, the way they deal with people. Just a small example of it. Okay, now. Somebody who's illuminated with that divine light, they have these type of things: honesty, contentment, compassion, friendliness, pleasantness, patience, dignity, forgiveness, thankfulness, amenability, meaning that there are people who can get along right with others, humility, respectfulness, softness, optimism, etiquette. When we're trying to evaluate a potential spouse, we should be looking at these things and trying to measure them based on how they're interacting, right? It's not just about the questions that we ask, but see how they walk into the room, or have somebody else look at this if you're not good at observing. See how they talk to your parents, see how they talk to your brothers and sisters, right? See how they leave, see how they eat their food. Just by observing a few things here and there, you can tell a lot about what sort of characteristics they have. And that will give us a good clue as to what sort of light there is inside them. Now, how important is this? Like, why do we single this out? You could say that, okay, brother, you know, this actually falls under taqwa. It's true. I mean, somebody who has taqwa also has good akhlaq. But the reason for singling it out is because in the ahadith, this is so important when it comes to making a marriage successful, that the imams themselves and the Prophet would single it out. They would say, look for somebody who has, in hadith we have, look for somebody who has religion and somebody who has good khulq. You know, like somebody whose religion and khulq pleases you, that's somebody that you should marry your daughters off to, for example. So, this is extremely important. One time, it's reported that Imam Sadat al-Islam was going somewhere. This is one of those stories that really makes us think and ponder, right? He sees a woman, he doesn't know her, but he sees that her behavior and her character is excellent. So he inquires about her, finds out that she's not married, and he proposes to her, and he marries her. There's a companion there, and he says that, you know, he's like looking at the Imam does, and he says, wait a minute. You know, some of these companions, they thought of themselves a little bit like, you know, like kind of like, you know, holier than thou sometimes, right? Like, Imam, you know, you didn't even ask about her family lineage, you know, like where is she coming from? You should do a little more, you know, research there, right? I mean, you should have taken the marriage seminar or something, you know, like what are you doing, right? I mean, he didn't say that, but okay. Anyhow, so the Imam al-Islam tells him that, no, don't you know that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, the gist of what he says is that, don't you know that Allah, by sending Islam as the final religion, that with Islam, Islam itself perfects those shortcomings that people have, and comes and perfects the faults that people have. As if the Imam al-Islam is trying to say that it's true that in the past, something like that would have been extremely important. But now, you see, somebody who has good character that stems from their Islam, right? That stems from their Islam. That Islam itself is enough to come in. It's such a powerful thing that it can wipe out or cover all other negative things that might be there. Right? And he could see that in this person, his being the Imam and being able to observe her character. He could see that this is somebody who had fully embraced Islam, who had good character. And if you have that, then you can make any marriage succeed. So this is extremely important. Both is a trait for us to be looking at, to, you know, inculcate in ourselves. Both is something that we're looking at in potential spouses, something that we're trying to help our spouses get to, and also something that if we have children, we're trying to, from a very early age, look in and see how we can help them get there. Human beings, when they're kids have the opposite of all those characteristics, right? You see this, right? A lot of kids are selfish, a lot of kids are like, you know, they're not friendly sometimes to like strangers, right? There's a lot of things that kids have problems with, right? But as they get older and older, and they get more realization, then they start to iron out these things. And this is where parents who are observant of what their kids are doing, who talk to them a lot, who spend time with them, who take them on outings, who just hang around, you know, that companionship is there. They'll be able to know exactly. I've talked to like mothers who know exactly what weaknesses their children have. And they know exactly, they have a plan as to what they're going to do in order to take care of these weaknesses. I find that extremely impressive. Other hadiths, do not marry your daughter to one who has bad character. Okay? The best of your woman is she who, when she's angry or she's angered, she doesn't blow up herself, she doesn't threaten to, like, you know, call the cops, she doesn't, you know, whatever, deprive her husband of whatever he needs. She says that, okay, I'm not gonna sleep until you copy with me. Let's talk about this, let's figure this out, right? This is not the way I want things to be. It troubles her. Right? It troubles her, the fact that her husband is upset. And people who have good character, this is the way it will be. That if they know that the other party is upset at all, they'll do everything they can in order to make them happy. Right? Because it's something that disturbs them to know that, you know, somebody, especially somebody whom Allah has placed love in their hearts towards, is upset. Okay, now, where does this come up? It comes up in times of difficulty especially. People who are cheerful, optimistic, who have this good character, they're able to deal with difficulties a lot better. And it's crucial to keep marriages successful. Let me just give you a couple examples. One of the responsibilities of a wife is that she should get ready and prepare herself for her husband every day. And she should be looking good for her husband. This is essential if marriages are to be successful. Now, at the beginning, you know, soon after the honeymoon, it's honeymoon time, whatever, you know, she got the latest set of you know, of makeup, and she's got, you know, really good clothes and everything, and she has time on her hands, and it's that feeling of like freshness and everything, it will happen. Right? But a lot of times after, you know, time passes, the honeymoon period wears out, especially when kids come, this becomes something which is very difficult for the women to keep up. Right? So if they do not have a good character, they don't have this trait of like wanting to please others, then this is something that will just kind of slip away. And that will be a very, you know, like a sort of like a dagger in the heart of the marriage, because this is something that is a need of the husband that she needs to fulfill. Same thing on the other side. For a man to notice, you know, things that his wife does for him, and then to take that effort to say thank you and to like appreciate that, and to like not just say it out of habit, actually mean it, and then to like, you know, go out of his way to like give gifts and like make compliments and appreciate her and these type of things, to listen to just to like listen sometimes, not to like offer advice, but just to listen. That takes, you know, good character. It takes patience. It takes like, you know, that that sort of care for other people's feelings. Right? So these things need to be measured. A man who doesn't have that type of sensitivity towards other people's feelings is somebody who, you know, might not make such a good husband. Like for example, you know, if a woman is meeting with a potential spouse, right, and it's cold outside, it's cold, and she's like shivering, but the husband doesn't notice anything. Okay, he just doesn't say anything about it, right? Then, I'm not saying that that's a no-go, I'm just saying that this is something that she needs to be aware of, that he doesn't have that level of some sensitivity about her, or about the people around him. On the other hand, if he's like, you know, asking her, you know, do you want a jacket, or, you know, something, you know, like, you know, do you want to go somewhere else? That's a good sign. That means he has, like, you know, other people's concerns in his mind as well, too.
Excuse me.
Yeah.
Hey, you mentioned the husband part, you said that compliments, and you said give gifts?
Yeah.
How often do you have to
give? The recommendation is to give gifts frequently.
All of them at once, or you know, at certain occasions.
Because the question is, how many gifts should we give? How many?
What is the gift supposed to be?
What is the gift supposed to be? Okay, the recommendation is to give lots of gifts, to give it frequently, and this goes back to. Let's go back to like just talking about typically like how. Studies have shown, all right, so with all respect to how studies have shown how women are, okay? This is based on studies and findings, right? And maybe even like if some hadith as well too, right? Studies show that women appreciate the gesture of getting a gift. And it's not always that important as to how expensive the gift was or even what it was, you know? Like sometimes you can buy like a whole bouquet of flowers for like $40, or you can buy a single rose, make it a good rose, but a single rose, you know? And it can mean all as much, correct? Or no? Okay, good, I'm not correct.
The correction is that the standard keeps on going up and up and up. So, every time I ask you that last time.
No, that's the wrong way of looking at it. It's not about
us. It's America, unfortunately.
But the way, like, it doesn't take much to.
There's about four more traits that we're going to cover here, inshallah. The next trait is compatibility. And this in Arabic is known as somebody being your kuf. You know, like in Surah Al-Ikhlas we say, وَلَمْ يَكُلْ لَهُ كُفُوًا أَحَدٌ. It comes from that same word. And in Hadith we're told that you should marry those who are compatible matches with you, those who are akfa, those who you are your equals or your matches. Now, what does it mean for somebody to be equal to you? Right? If you just look at the word itself, it means that somebody who in every way possible is the most similar to you. You know, when it comes to every aspect about you. But remember that the agreement that we have when it comes to dealing with the traditions of the Ahlul Bayt is that we don't look at them in isolation. We always look at them in conjunction with other ahadith. So the imams, you know, were asked about, okay, what does it mean for somebody to be a kuf of one another person? Meaning that they are the match of somebody else. So then the imams would say that believers are the compatible matches of other believers. Meaning that if somebody is a believer, then what they need to find is somebody else who's a believer, and that will be enough of a match for them. And then in another tradition we're told, marry a suitor whose practice of religion and trustworthiness please you, whoever he may be. And so there, if you look at it, I mean the clause here, where the Imam says whoever he may be, or the Prophet Imam says whoever he may be, That's important, because what they're saying is that these are the things you should be looking at, the practice of religion and then the trustworthiness. Make sure that these match up. Alright, you're a person who has taqwa, look for somebody who has taqwa. You're a person who is a Shia Muslim, look for somebody who is a Shia Muslim. And then look at their trustworthiness. This is a key word for their akhlaq. If you're a person who cares about akhlaq, look for somebody who has good akhlaq as well too. But this word compatibility, it means more than just, you know, faith. It means more than just character. And you know, it has a more wider meaning. And so, what about other things about compatibility? You know, what about things like, you know, similar background? All right, you know, like my parents came from this country, this person's parents came from this country. Income bracket, right? Middle class, lower class, etc. So societal status, right? In the sense that, like, I don't know, like, you know, you can interpret that however you want. I mean, so whatever they're in, like, you know, are they from that bracket or this bracket? Intellectual compatibility, meaning that somebody is, you know, like when it comes to the way that we discuss things, if we're people who like to discuss things, you know, that person's at the same level as me, in the sense that we can have discussions together. Or when it comes to, if we don't like to discuss things, we like to, you know, we're not people who discuss things, we're people who just kind of, I don't know, when it comes time to free time, we engage in different leisurely activities. Well, we have a similar match in that respect. Family compatibility, meaning that their family is similar to my family. All right, and then when it comes to ideal age gap as well too, like compatibility doesn't mean that they're the same age, but rather, you know, typically it's said that, you know, that if the husband is older, that leads to a better marriage. And then the age gap that's suggested by one scholar, one expert, is 3 to 7 years. These are all also factors that need to be taken into account, and they're very serious. They're very important. And if somebody is looking to have a marriage where, you know, there's a good chance of success and where it will be easy, in order, like an easy match, then they'll look for people who are compatible. Right? It's a logical thing. Right? The more similar that person is to me, then the easier it is for me to get along. Because after all, we're going to be living together, and we're going to have to like share common food together, we're going to hang out with each other. So the more like they are to me, then the more easier it's going to be. But does that mean that it's necessary for all these things to be in place? That a marriage can't work if these things aren't in place? No. Okay, and that's what we saw in the previous slide, that what's being emphasized is the religion and the trustworthiness. The other things can be overcome. And so, on one hand, even though it would be easier, it doesn't mean that we should make these the have-tos, that these must be in place. Because if we do so, we're going to be narrowing ourselves to, the pool will be too narrowed. We're not going to find somebody, maybe, who's appropriate in many cases. Or we're going to be filtering out people that we should be accepting because they're outstanding when it comes to these other two things. The practice of religion and the trustworthiness. So this is one of those things where we really need to look at ourselves. Okay, if I'm a person who has very, you know, I'm very culturally oriented, right? I've been brought up this way. You know, I only see things according to my culture. I only eat my type of food. I don't eat any other types of food. I only speak my language and I'm very proud of this language, etc. Then that's the way I am, right? That's the way I've been brought up. Then I have to be looking for somebody who matches me. But if I'm somebody who has flexibility, you know, I'm a person who is like a Muslim of all cultures, right? I'm American, right? And I'm proud of my Americanness in the sense that, I mean, I'm multicultural. Yeah, I have my own language, maybe my own food, right? But I'm willing to, you know, I'm appreciative of others' cultures. I have some sophistication when I deal with other people, right? I don't like separate people. I don't make comments, racial comments, you know, which isn't right anyways. But I look at people as my brothers first, and then like the culture and these type of things are secondary. You know, I'm American, right? And then it would be easier, and I need to be looking beyond just these types of narrowing myself when it comes to these type of things. So on one hand, it's easier, okay? But on the other hand, it shouldn't be restrictive. And also, we have to look at the reality of the situation. I think I mentioned this earlier in one of the speeches that, I mean, you know, we have a responsibility of having our religion spread. You know, this is a great trust that God has placed in our hands. We have a responsibility of conveying it to people in this country, right? It's a beautiful religion. If we're not going to do it, Allah's going to bring other people who are going to do it. And one of the best ways of doing that is through marriage, right? I mean, that's the way Islam is always spread in other countries, right? So why doesn't it happen with us as well too? And there's nothing wrong with that. It's going to spread, but it should be the case that we have this type of outlook on things. And we're not so, we're not going to hold on to other things at the price of, you know, ignoring those things which are very, very extremely important. Okay? I hope I'm presenting the balance here. On one hand, we're not saying that these things, on the other hand, we don't want to, you know, make these, like, I mean, we're trying to be flexible people and account for the possibility of you know, these things not being in place, but we're still able to overcome those challenges. Yes, sister. knowing that this family is you know, it's a family where everyone who comes out or
that they can work at establishing for themselves, for their children as well too. They can be creating a family which, you know, itself is proud of the fact that it is a family of believers, and they're working together to, you know, establish themselves. And then they're passing that as a gift to the future generations. Also, when we're talking about good families, you know, sometimes people wonder, okay, does that mean that we can't marry people who are, you know, coming to Islam from other religions? Because obviously they're coming from non-Muslim families. The answer is no, because look at what the Hadith says, is the best of your woman is she who is respected in her family. In Arabic, the word is aziza. She's somebody who has dignity. She's respected. Well, that can be also, you know, happening in a non-Muslim family as well too, especially those who are ignorant and not willfully turning away from Islam. They're ignorant about it. You know, she comes from a good family in that sense. They have good morals and values. They act upon, you know, the virtues that they know. And then, you know, let's say that she accepts Islam. She becomes Muslim. Obviously, the other things that we mentioned will be there. They'll have to have flexibility. They'll have to have, you know, sophistication when it comes to dealing with the in-laws and all that. But it doesn't mean that, okay, they're completely written off now that this isn't the case. Again, this falls into one of those characteristics that are nice to have, but it's not one of the must-to-have characteristics that we're going to put when we come in with that list. Now, the fifth trait is chastity. Remember that dua that we said it was good to recite after the prayer, the Torah prayer? It says, O Allah, grant me the most chaste among them. This is a virtue which is particularly mentioned. And you could say again that it falls under the bucket of taqwa. And it does. But because it's particularly mentioned, we're going to mention here also separately. Now, this encompasses a number of different things that we're trying to look for in the spouse, and also things that we're trying to inculcate within ourselves. Hijab, limited mixing of genders, all right? Modest interaction, language and body language, keeping appropriate company. These are the types of things that we can be observing when we're discussing with potential candidates, and also when we're asking about them, asking their friends about them, asking, you know, family members about them, people in the community who know them, we can be inquiring about these type of things. So this person here, how is it that he carries himself with opposite gender? Is he one of the guys who's always like trying to, you know, make the last joke and always trying to hang around, you know, and, you know, sort of, you know, afterwards, you know, when you know everyone's leaving, he's kind of like hanging out in the foyer there just waiting for people to talk to? Or is he somebody who keeps respectful, interacts, but in an appropriate sort of way, doesn't go beyond the bounds? Keeping appropriate company also is a sign of somebody who is chaste, meaning that, you know, do they hang out with like people, you know, like for example, do they hang out with like couples, right? Do they hang out with like other people, a guy and girl type of groups, right? Or do they just keep themselves with guys? And same thing with the girls as well. So this is a good sign. It tells us a lot about their level of chastity. Now, this is something that needs to be in place both before and after marriage, if we want to see marriages be successful. Now, why is that the case? It's very interesting. If you look at the philosophy of why this is the case, this is according to scholars. They say that, first of all, if when somebody is holding themselves chaste, right, they're not satisfying those desires that are natural to them in people other than their spouses, then what that means is their need of their spouse is going to be even greater. Right? If a guy, for example, is holding himself carefully when it comes to interacting with the opposite gender, then when it comes to that, those natural needs that he has, whether it be, you know, talking or looking or speaking or whatever it may be, that's going to be even stronger, and then he'll need his wife even more. Same thing with the wife as well too. You know, she's not seeking, you know, comfort and solace by pouring her heart out to guys who are non-mahram. You know, her husband is her source of comfort when it comes to these type of things. So when there's more need of one another, that's when the marriage is more successful. Right? Because then the natural, you know, purpose of marriage starts becoming fulfilled. And also, like for example, when a husband isn't looking at, you know, he's holding his glance down, he's not staring at non-mahrams, when it comes to the beauty of his wife, the natural physical beauty, he'll appreciate that more. Because if even if she's beautiful, if he's in the habit of looking at other women, then obviously, like, you know, he'll be, you know, might even start comparing or whatever it is, that it won't have the same freshness and attractiveness for him. But if she's the only woman that he's really looking at in that way, then whenever he looks at her, it will be a source of great delight for him. And he'll take more pleasure out of that relationship that he has with her. Now, when the husband's taking more pleasure, that means that his love for his wife is greater, and then he's going to want to serve her more, and reciprocally show love to her. And this creates a more successful and healthy marriage. So, people who are interested in getting married, people who are interested in keeping their marriages successful, they need to reevaluate their ties and behavior with non-mahrams. This isn't about, you know, like looking at everybody and saying that, okay, you know, Islam tells us that, you know, we can't trust anybody, and so therefore we have to like always like be, you know, keeping hijab and making sure that, you know, we don't interact inappropriately with the opposite sex. First of all, there is room for interaction, you know, in a modest and appropriate way when it comes to like discussing things, planning things, you know, asking questions, going to classes, academics. You know, that's not prohibited. What's meant is unnecessary and above the limit. Second of all, it's not about suspecting and saying everyone else is like, you know, that they're out to like, you know, look at me in the wrong way or whatever like that. That's why I have to like wear hijab. No, we have to look at ourselves and see that we ourselves, we know ourselves, we have weaknesses. And God has given us means of protecting ourselves. Like in a hadith in Najm al-Balagha, Imam al-Islam is reported to have said that one of the characteristics of a believer who has taqwa is that they are always suspecting themselves. We're supposed to think good of other people, but always be thinking a little bit negatively about ourselves. Not in a way that it gets excessive and we become depressed, but just that we should, you know, take the extra precaution when it comes to ourselves. We know, you know, the reality of what we are. And so, in that respect, we need to take the extra precaution. And of course, as I mentioned before, that not being friends with the opposite gender doesn't mean that we're not friendly with them. That's necessary. We need to, you know, show that Islam is a religion which allows us to interact, but in an appropriate sort of way. Okay, traits 6 and 7, responsibility and good planning skills. This is especially important when we're talking about sisters who are looking for good husbands. These are traits which are important, they also are very appealing for them as well too, typically. There's a hadith which says that the best of men is he who takes care of his wife so that she doesn't have to rely on others. The wife should be demanding and expecting that the husband's going to take care of her. Not just about providing her with the money, but in general, if he's going to be the leader and she's going to be following him, in the way that we talked about in the last session, then he has to be somebody who has the qualities of being able to manage. Now, of course, we're not talking about everyone who's necessarily a great leader and they're, you know, they're fit for like leading the community and being president, whatever. Everyone has their own limitations, but at least to the level where he can manage the affairs of the family. So, how can these traits be measured? We can see, first of all, is this somebody who takes care of his parents and his siblings? This is something that we can ask, we can see. Second of all, is this person a hard-working person? How do we find that out? We find out what they do in their free time. In the summertime, do they just, you know, laze around? Or are they people who consistently have taken on responsibilities and busied themselves? Right? That's a good way of knowing how much of a sense of responsibility that they can carry. And then, how do they manage their money? This is something that we can ask. Is this somebody who just is spendthrift? Whenever he or she wants, they just go and they spend money on restaurants or flying this place and taking a vacation? Or the people who like are people who have budgets, you know, they don't spend out of their own means, they don't find themselves borrowing from other people all the time. These are good questions to ask and good things to look for. The last trait we're going to discuss is good looks. Right? Good looks is something which is important, and it tends to be, it's important for both parties, but it tends to be of more importance for the guy, because men are such that they are very visually oriented. Right, and what they see affects them. So, it's something that we have to take into account, and everyone according to his own level. You know, it seems that in my experience in talking to different guys, everyone has their own set of requirements when it comes to this, and they need to look within themselves and see. Some people don't put too much importance on this. Some people do. So they need to be honest with themselves. The important thing is that it should not be the only criterion. Right, somebody shouldn't marry somebody just based on looks. This is obvious, right? It has to come hand in hand with the other things as well too. We have a hadith who say that somebody who marries a woman just based on her wealth and her looks, then Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala he's not going to find either of them in her. It's to this effect. But somebody who marries on the basis of religion, He's going to find religion, and he's going to find beauty, and he's going to find wealth in the one he marries. So, we have to look for other than just, we look beyond the beauty. And also, true beauty is on the inside and the outside. Okay, it's something which emanates from within. Maybe this is, you've experienced this before. Sometimes you meet somebody for the first time, and they're attractive, they're good-looking people. And like, for example, it's the first day of school, and there's somebody who's good-looking, right? They tend to be the ones that people look to, and they're popular, just on the basis of their looks. But then you'll see, after like a few weeks, that sometimes this person, because they have bad character, right, they don't have a good insight, then their looks, it doesn't carry them too much further. They start to lose their popularity among the people. And you yourself, before you used to look at this person, you know, in a way that you admire them, now you're like, okay, you forget about the good looks and you focus more on their bad character and bad behavior. And the opposite is true as well. So somebody who you didn't notice at the beginning for their looks, because of their inner character, that starts to shine, and then that becomes a source of attractiveness to other people. That's why you find some of the most, you know, attractive people weren't the most good-looking people. Like some of the ulama. Some of the ulama, if you look at their pictures, and you just were to say, okay, just look at them for what, purely on the basis of their looks. Don't look at that nur that's coming from their face. You find that they're not the most attractive of people, but when you see them and you see the way that they're walking, the way they are, you find them the most beautiful of people. And everyone, and this is someone like Ayatollah Bachchan, I mean, maybe some people say, oh yeah, he was good looking, but you know, he wouldn't win a beauty, you know, beauty contest or something. But everyone loved him. Everyone loved him. And you just had to be at the funeral, you know, to observe how people were attached to him. You know, I was there at that time. So what is inner beauty? Inner beauty consists of the other characteristics that we talked about. Taqwa, akhlaq, ilm. These sort of things will shine and make somebody beautiful. Now, there's some practical tips, because we're going to try to take this to a practical level as well too. One tip is, according to hadith and also according to observation, that people who are extremely beautiful, that can lead to them having an arrogant side to their personality. So if this is the case, then you need to be aware of this. Those of you who are like this, you know, in your self-building, make sure that you're aware of this. And also, people who are parents, if they know that their children have been gifted in this way, they need to work at trying to counter that according to the guidelines that Islam has provided for us. Also, being attractive isn't about trying to be somebody that you aren't. Okay, this is for the sisters. Like, we shouldn't imagine that the only thing that guys are looking for are people who look like, you know, the beauty pageant people, or like the models, or you know, the celebrities that are out there in the media. That's not what defines beauty when it comes to the way God created us. Beauty is working with whatever God gave us and doing the best with it, doing the shukr with it, using it the way that God wants us to do. If a sister does that, then she'll find that, you know, even if she, compared to the standard that they put out there, she's not considered beautiful, she can make herself into an attractive person. One of these is at the physical level, is that having a regular exercise routine. This is something that needs to continue even after marriage, even after we have our children. Unfortunately, in some cultures, as soon as the child comes, then all exercise goes out the drain, right? And you see that you know, the idea of keeping the figure, it just isn't there anymore, right? We need to strive towards having good physical, you know, habits without going to the extremes. This isn't too hard. It's just a matter of keeping regular exercise every other day, whatever it is, you know, half an hour every other day, whatever they say, in order to keep fit. We're not trying to be like, you know, do bodybuilding. Just keeping fit. And there's a lot of hadith to this effect as well too. It's not just that we're saying this. There's a lot of hadith which say that if you want to, for example, have a good actions, you have to have a good, healthy body. So much recommendation to keep ourselves fit. Even in the Quran, those who are gifted by God, some of them are gifted with strength, right? This is a sign that having strength, being fit is something which is necessary. And then also observing the Islamic dietary guidelines, a lot of this, you know, it can help us both spiritually and also on a physical level. Somebody who tries to, like for example, they're presented with the opportunity of eating something that they don't need to eat. Okay, they're satisfied, and now something else comes on the table. If they say no, okay, if they say no to that, then on a spiritual level, this is according to one of the teachers, it was interesting, he said that if somebody does that, it's the first time that they're actually doing this, on a spiritual level, they might for the first time actually feel what it means for them to combat their nafs. Right? They might feel that, because like, you know, we're supposed to be people who are constantly trying to engage in this battle, which is the greatest battle that we can fight with our nafs, right? But some people don't even know that there's a battle going on. They don't even know what it means to have an opponent. But this is one way of seeing it. Okay, there's one opportunity. You already, it's not like you're hungry, you need that energy. It's just something that's there. Try to say no, and then see what it's like. Right, this will give us a good taste on the spiritual level, and it will be something that will present a new challenge to us. On a physical level as well too, people who observe this have reported that it can create enormously positive benefits by just not overeating. By stopping right before we are right before just like a little bit hungry, right before we get to that feeling that we're not hungry anymore. Something simple like that can create enormous effects when it comes to the psychological state, when it comes to the physical state, and when it comes to improving relationships as well too with their family and with their spouses. Okay. Also, when it comes to beauty, we should understand that it's not just about physical, even things like good character, having good faith, being an optimistic person, a person who speaks well and smiles, a person who speaks appropriately, like women who speak with that sense of chastity, that's all signs of, they lend to the beauty, grooming and hygiene, this is making the best with what, doing the best with Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala gave us, these can lend to outer beauty. As a community, one thing that we can do here in this area is to try to encourage sports more on an official level, like having that culture of that, we're people who care about, I'm not talking about the sports where there's no physical activity involved. Unfortunately, some communities, they play volleyball. And it's not that volleyball that they play, like the American style volleyball where you it's like bumps that spike and people are running around. It's the type of volleyball where like, as soon as you get the thing, you just hit it right back over again. And so it's like, well, where's the exercise, right? They're like, we don't do it for the exercise, we just do it for the fun of it, right? Or like, I'm sorry, but the people, the golfers, like, I don't know, some of the golfers, a lot of times, golf is just about, like, I don't know what it's about, right? Anyhow, especially if you're taking, like, the card and away with that. If we can have an emphasis on champion sport, that for the purpose of encouraging, physical activity, right, that's a very good thing. And we see that in Iran, for example, the Rahbar, he puts a lot of emphasis on this, not because, just for the sake of competition, because there's benefits both on the on a level of physical benefits and also spiritual benefits as well too. Also, husbands should buy their wives those things they need in order to make themselves beautiful at home. They should invest in this thing, whether it comes to clothing, makeup, whatever it is. That's something which is very much recommended. Okay. Now, we are almost done. There's just a few slides left. I just want to pause here. Are there any questions about the traits? Because we're going to move on to now the next point, which is how to actually use this list, and then the point about investigation in the meeting. Any questions? Comments? Okay. All right, moving right along. So now we have this list. What do we do with it? If it's the case that in the course of our interaction, halal interaction, whatever it is, that we already have some people in mind, or one person in mind, that's not a bad thing. We can, that's good. We can compare it to the list that we have and see whether or not this is based on fancy and wish, or whether it's actually based on reality. Does that person actually match with what I have or not? A lot of times people aren't in that situation. They don't know. And so they need to rely on other people. So they want to find people who can help them. There are people out there who would like to do this thing and will help, because there's a lot of reward also mentioned in a hadith for somebody who marries people off and actually sets people up. So this is something which there are resources available. Also at a community level, we can have matchmakers there who are well known, advertised on the website, announced. And these are the people, if people are interested in getting married, then they can go to them. And it's not a matter of somehow somebody's weak if they have to go to a matchmaker. No, it's a good thing, right? I mean, you're trusting people who have done the research, who have already contacted the references to make sure that this person is legitimate, what they've said on their application is actually legit, and then you're taking that research, you're building upon it, and then you're finding good people, inshallah, to marry. The champions don't have to be the parents, it can be like a trusted friend, a family, like a maybe a brother, a sister, brother-in-law, sister-in-law, or an uncle, whatever, but the parents should be, as much as possible, kept in the loop, because they're going to be very important as the, you know, as this whole process unfolds. In terms of where to look, the advice is to start locally, right? Because when you're local, you know the families a lot better, and also you have that, you know, the familiarity as well too. You're not bringing somebody from a foreign culture into this land. So this habit of people, you know, immediately looking back home for the right spouse, right, bringing the person from back home, I'm not saying those people are doing something wrong, but we should try to encourage looking locally first. Okay, and in particular, I want to address this to the guys, that remember, we're not looking for angels on the earth. Okay, if there's a sister, and she's muhajjaba, alright, and she's doing her best, right, and okay, yeah, maybe there were some times in the past where she slipped, and she's done tawbah for that, and now, you know, like, you know, she's overcome that, right? Then we should look beyond that, right? We should be, I mean, like the value of a sister who's been able to preserve her faith in this culture, maybe it's a lot more than somebody who back home has, for example, kept the hijab. Okay, so let's try to first look locally. There's a lot of sisters who complain. They say that, you know, there's not that many guys who are even interested in marrying religious girls, unfortunately. And then they only go and look abroad, right? That's not the right attitude to have. The rewards, I mean, the compatibility can be a lot greater if they're coming from the same culture that we're in. After all, we've been born and raised and brought up in America. But of course, you know, if that doesn't work out, then we can start to branch out. There's other cities; they have matchmakers as well too. There's other communities out there. There's people who are, you know, who know kind of what's going on. It's just a matter of connecting with these people. And if you want more practical tips, then, you know, come, let me know, and I can give you more leads. Okay. Now, it's very important that we actually investigate. All right, it's not just about reading and then doing tawakkul. It's about actually investigating. Why? First of all, you know, we have the tradition that said marriage is like slavery. If one of you wants to marry off his daughter, he has given her to slavery. So look carefully at whom you marry your noble daughter to. Women are a necklace. That's for the girls. For the guys, women are a necklace, you know, kind of like a collar, right? So look carefully to ensure you get the right one, right? Because once it's there, you're not going to be able to take it off. According to one expert, marriage is the most important event in your life. Now look at how much research we do when it comes to choosing a college, when it comes to like what buying a laptop, when it comes to choosing a car, right? At least we do research, we investigate, we talk to references. So we should at least do this same, but if not that, actually a lot more when it comes to choosing an appropriate spouse. Now, when we're talking to people, we have to talk to the right people who know the candidate in depth. Sometimes the best people to talk to are people who have married into that family. Like, for example, that the guy you're considering, he has another brother who is married already. So talk to that wife, because she knows that family as an outsider. She'll be able to tell you things about them. An important point here is that revealing negative information in the situation is not backbiting. This is one of those places where the ghibah is allowed. It's allowed in this place to disclose information that was hidden, which is relevant to marriage. All right. Now, if you talk to somebody and all they tell you is good things about that person, then they're probably not a good reference. Okay, like this has happened before, that, you know, we talked to somebody, and they were just spouting, you know, gushing praises, right? I'm like, okay, well, you know, thanks, but, you know, that wasn't very useful. Because everyone has some faults, right? And it's important, we shouldn't let, like, our sense of, like, not wanting to do riba prevent us from sharing that which is necessary and important. And we need to find those people who are willing to reveal these things. And not reveal everything, but reveal those things which are necessary when it comes to making the decision for marriage. For example, if there's some sin that person committed a long time ago, they've repented from that, they've moved away from it, and it's not going to affect them anymore, then there's no need to, that shouldn't be disclosed if this person was inquiring. But when it comes to like a sin that right now they're performing, and they know about it, other people don't know about it, then it's their responsibility to tell them that this person, for example, you know, is a womanizer, this person, you know, goes to clubs, whatever, that needs to be shared. Now, this question comes up, which is that, okay, we've done all this work, we've taken this class, we've you know, talked to references, we found people, whatever, but we still don't know for sure. Like, there's still some doubt that we have. Like, we talked to them, we looked at every angle, what about now? You know, how do we know for sure, for sure? At this point, this is the place where we have to do tawakkul. We have to do our duty and let Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala take care of his duty. He said that you act upon what you know, and I will teach you what you don't know. So if we've done our best in terms of understanding what Ahlul Bayt have to say on this thing, we've looked at our own selves, we've done our identification of our faults, our weaknesses, our needs, gone through the whole process, talked to references, at this point, we have to leave it in God's hands, right? Assuming that everything has clicked, you know, everything matches, we have a pretty good sense that this is something that's going to work out. They meet the criteria, as we said, 70% or more, all the must-haves are in place, then we should go forward with the name of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Also, investigation isn't just before the meeting, after the meetings as well too. A lot of times stuff will come up and then you want to go and check it. So that's good, you know, that you get more specific. Then you call the same people, you said, I talked to you back then, I just wanted to follow up and ask you a few more questions, you know. And then you can check some things. For example, that person told you some things, now you want to go and make sure that some of them are a little bit hard to believe, incredulous. So you go and check them with the references and say, you don't say that this person said this, is this true or not? But you ask them in an indirect way to see whether or not what they said corroborates with what, you know, that person said. Is that okay? Alright. This is important. Okay, I've seen people who don't look into the honesty of somebody and then they regret it afterwards. Because somebody, if they're in a different city, especially they can make a whole lie about themselves, right? So this is something that needs to be, it's one of those things that we need to be looking for. Okay, now why do people not investigate properly? Some reasons is that, you know, they trust somebody fully, they're like, okay, you know, Maulana X, you know, he recommended this person, right? So therefore we're going to trust him. Okay, well, that's the false sense of like reliance on false means, right? Just because somebody recommended it doesn't mean that they're saying, okay, for sure this person is going to be the right person. Unless for some reason they know them both parties extremely well, and they have a lot of experience in this area, maybe you can take their word for it. But otherwise, that's just a recommendation. Now we need to do our own research as well too. We can't be lagging in our research. Sometimes people say that, okay, I know his father, I know his father's father, we were best of friends back then, you know, it's a match, right? That's okay, that's fine, that comes to the family. What about the other criteria over there? Sometimes people misinterpret the hadith. They say that if a suitor comes to you whose character and religion please you, then marry your daughter to him, or else there will be turmoil on the earth and great corruption. So they said, okay, this person is religious, right, coming from a good family, you know, a good person. Okay, you know, yes, we don't want turmoil to appear in the earth, right? Okay, that's fine, but let's look at this very carefully. Whose character and religion please you? Character is something it's more than just somebody who has a smile on their face and like praise, right? It's a lot more sophisticated than that. And so for us to, like, you know, look at things more carefully, really examine who this person is, really see whether they're compatible or not, that's something which is definitely justified. And it's not going to cause turmoil on the earth and great corruption. Of course, we can't have our expectations too high or be too picky or looking at other things and bringing them into and ignoring those must-haves. Okay, somebody who has a false sense of tawakkul also, somebody who has a false understanding of istikhara as well too, they don't want to do the work, they're just going to do istikhara. Okay, whatever istikhara says, that's what we're going to go and do. Right, maybe you've heard about this happening, right? Okay, that's not a valid way of using istikhara. Istikhara comes in the picture when we've done our work and we're still kind of stuck, you know, we're not sure if there's arguments both ways. You know, there's a lot of good things, but for some reason we're just trying to have that good thing, then maybe that's a case for doing istikhara. If some of the other means are exhausted, like consulting with other people, examining the situation, you know, gaining knowledge about it, etc. Okay, we need to look at things like their family, their friends, their leadership qualities, how well they kept promises. Right, this is things that we can ask people, their level of honesty as well. And then finally, when it comes to the meeting, there are certain rules when it comes to the meeting about what we can do and we can't do. I'm not going to go through this in detail for the purpose of time, but I just want to mention that on one hand, we need to understand that just because people are meeting for the first time or second time or third time, whatever it is, you know, for the purpose of marriage, it doesn't mean that they're mahram with each other. So they have to be, you know, having some sense of, like, you know, decorum and observing that, okay, they're not mahram, they have to keep emotions kind of like away from, they can't be like opening and pouring their hearts out to each other. But at the same time, we want to try to understand what kind of people they are, and so if we're very formal, right? If we're very formal and we treat them like total strangers, we don't open up to them, there's no smile, there's no like pleasantness, you know, there's no like, you know, seeking personal information, sharing personal thoughts, then we're not going to really get a good sense of what kind of people they are. We have to strike a healthy balance. How many times can we meet before deciding? Recommendation is to meet at least twice, because the first time you meet, sometimes, you know, like, for whatever reason, you can kind of be, I don't know, whatever, you might not see everything about them. If you meet a second time, preferably in a different type of setting, other than just in the same place, and that can give you more insight. But you can meet even more than that too, there's no problem in that. Just extending it to like, you know, many meetings, one after the other, then it seems like there's no purpose in that, because after a while, then you run out of important things to discuss, it's time to make a decision. How close can you get without being married? We talked about that. Okay. What to discuss? All right, there's some things that are recommended to like discuss. Inshallah, you can get a hold of this slide if you want to look at this further. But I just want to mention that part of this should just be casual conversation. Essentially, you're just trying to like get a feel for what it's like to be with that person. It's not all about, okay, let's get down to business, okay, let's talk about serious things. Okay, number one, you know, what would you do in this situation? Number two, what do you think about living home with the parents? No. Try to be like human beings, just relax a little bit. Okay? A lot of this, like just casual conversation will give you a good general feel about what kind of people they are. If things are going well, then you can start talking about a few more serious things. Alright. Okay, there's some cultural things that are there, you know, that's probably, you know, a discussion for another time about, you know, Sayyids only marrying Sayyids, and, you know, not doing Qudah ever, or, you know, that once you get the nikah recited, then you can't interact with each other until the ghusl takes place. I don't know, these things that culture brings in that can, you know, have negative impacts on the quality of that relationship. Expensive weddings, you know, putting education above getting married, needing to wait for older siblings to get married, etc. These things all need their own discussion, their own place, but hopefully, inshallah, throughout the course of this presentation, you've developed an understanding of the Islamic perspective on these things. Not all culture is bad, and some of it can be to our benefit as well, too. Okay, I want to pause. Okay, we're done with the presentation. Just lastly, we'll just see if there's any last parting comments or questions, inshallah. Yes, brother.
There's one point, last slide.